Chapter 22. Aboard the steamer Eli Reynolds, Mississippi River, October 1857. On a cool evening in early autumn, Abner Marsh and the Eli Reynolds finally left St. Louis and headed downstream in search of the fever dream. Marsh would just as soon have left several weeks earlier, but there had been too much to do. He'd had to wait for the Eli Reynolds to get back from her latest trip up the Illinois and check her over to make sure she was fit for the lower river and hire himself a couple of Mississippi pilots. Marsh had claims to settle as well, from planters and shippers who'd entrusted St. Louis-bound freight to the Fever Dream down in New Orleans and were irate at the steamer's disappearance. Marsh might have insisted they share his loss, but he'd always prided himself on being fair, so he paid them off 50 cents on the dollar. There was also the unpleasant task of talking to Mr. Jeffers' relations. Marsh figured he could hardly tell them what had really happened, so he finally settled for the yellow fever yarn. Other folks had brothers or sons or husbands still unaccounted for, and they pestered Marsh with questions he couldn't answer. And he had to deal with a government inspector and a man from the Pilots Association, and he had accounts to square and books to go over and preparations to make, and it all toted up into a month of delay, frustration, and bother. But all the while, Marsh kept on looking. When the letters that Green had sent out on his behalf got no response, he sent out more. He met incoming steamers as often as he could find the time and asked after the Fever Dream, after Joshua York, after Carl Fram and Whitey Blake and Hairy Mike Dunn and Toby Lanyard. He hired a couple of detectives and sent them downriver, with instructions to find out what they could. He even borrowed a trick from Joshua and started buying newspapers from all up and down the river system. He spent his nights poring over the shipping columns, the advertisements, the lists of steamboat arrivals and departures from cities as distant as Cincinnati and New Orleans and St. Paul. He frequented the planter's house and other river haunts even more than was his custom, and asked 1,000 questions, and learned nothing. The Fever Dream was gone, it seemed, just plain gone from the river. No one had seen her. No one had talked to Whitey Blake or Mr. Fram or Hairy Mike or heard anything about them. The newspapers didn't list her coming or going.
"It ain't sensible," Marsh complained loudly to the officers of the Eli Reynolds a week before their departure. "She's 360 foot long, brand new, fast enough to make any steamboatman blink. A boat like that has got to get noticed."
"Unless she went down," suggested Cat Grove, the Eli Reynolds' short, wiry mate. "There's places on the river deep enough to drown whole towns. Could be she sunk with all aboard."
"No,"
said Marsh stubbornly. He hadn't told them the whole story. He didn't see how he could. None of them had been aboard the Fever Dream. They'd never believe him.
"No, she ain't sunk. She's down there somewhere hiding from me, but I'm going to find her."
"How?" asked Jurger, the captain of the Eli Reynolds.
"It's a long river," Marsh admitted, "and it's got lots of creeks and smaller rivers and bayous leading off it. Cut-offs and chutes and bends and all kinds of places a steamer can hide where she won't be seen easy. But it ain't so long that it can't be searched. We can start at one end and go to the other, and ask questions along the way. And if we reach New Orleans and we still ain't found her, then we can do the same on the Ohio and the Missouri and the Illinois and the Yazoo and the Red River and wherever the hell we got to go to find that goddamn boat."
"Could take a while," said Jurger.
"And if it does..."
Jurger shrugged, and the officers of the Eli Reynolds traded uncertain glances. Abner Marsh scowled.
"Don't you worry your head about how long it's going to take," he snapped. "You just get my steamboat ready, you hear?"
"Yes, sir, Captain," Jurger said.
He was a tall, stooped, gaunt old man with a quiet voice, and he'd been working steamboats since there had been steamboats, so nothing much surprised him anymore, and his tone said as much. When the day came, Abner Marsh wore his white captain's coat with a double row of silver buttons. It seemed fitting somehow. He ate himself a huge supper at the planter's house. The provisions on the Eli Reynolds weren't too good, and the cook was barely fit to scrub out Toby's fry pans, and walked down to the landing. The Eli Reynolds had her steam up, Marsh saw with approval. Still, she didn't look like much. She was an upper river boat, built small and narrow and low for the shallow, tight streams where she had to ply her trade. She was less than 1/4 as long as the vanished Fever Dream, and about 1/2 as wide, and full loaded she could carry maybe 150 tons of cargo, against 1,000 tons of the larger steamer. The Reynolds had only 2 decks. There was no Texas, and the crew occupied the forward portion of the cabins on the boiler deck. She seldom had any cabin passengers anyway. A single big high-pressure boiler drove her stern wheel, and she was as plain as all get-out. She was near empty of cargo now, so Marsh could see the boiler sitting well forward. Rows of plain, whitewashed wooden pillars supported the upper decks, looking like rickety stilts, and the columns that held up the weathered promenade roof were square and simple, plain as a picket fence. The aft wheelhouse was a big, square wooden box, the stern wheel a sorry-looking afterthought, its red paint faded and streaked from long use. Elsewhere, paint was flaking. The pilot house was a damn wood and glass outhouse set atop the steamboat, and the stubby chimneys were unadorned black iron. The Eli Reynolds showed her age sitting there in the water. She looked terribly weary and a bit lopsided, as if she was about to keel over and sink. She was a damn unlikely match for the huge, powerful Fever Dream. But she was all he had now, Abner Marsh reflected, and she would have to do. He walked on down to the steamer and climbed aboard, across a stage that had been badly worn by the tread of countless boots. Cat Grove met him on the forecastle.
"All ready, Captain." "Tell the pilot to take her out," Marsh said.
Grove shouted up the order, and the Eli Reynolds sounded its whistle. The blast was thin and plaintive, and hopelessly brave, Marsh thought. He clomped up the steep, narrow stair to the main cabin, which was dim and cramped-feeling, barely 40 foot long. The carpet was bare in spots, and the landscapes painted on the stateroom doors had long since faded into dullness. The whole interior of the steamer had an odour about it of stale food and sour wine and oil and smoke and sweat. It was unpleasantly hot, too, and the single-plane skylight was too grimed over to admit much light. Jurger and the off-duty pilot were drinking cups of black coffee at a round table when Marsh entered.
"My lard aboard?" Marsh asked.
Jurger nodded.
"Not much else aboard that I saw," Marsh commented.
Jurger frowned.
"I figured you'd like it that way, Cap'n. Loaded up would be slower, and there'd be more stops to make, too."
Abner Marsh pondered that, and nodded in approval.
"Good," he said. "Makes sense. My other package get delivered?"
"In your cabin," Jurger said.
Marsh took his leave and retired to his stateroom. The bunk creaked beneath him when he sat down on its edge, opened the package and took out the rifle and shells. He examined it carefully, hefting it in his hand, sighting down the barrel. It felt good. Maybe your ordinary pistol or rifle shot was nothing to the night folks, but this was something else again, custom-made to his order by the best gunsmith in St. Louis. It was a buffalo gun, with a short, wide, octagonal barrel designed to be fired from horseback and stop a charging buffalo in its tracks. The 50 custom shells were bigger than any the gunsmith had ever made before.
"Hell," the man had complained, "these'll blow your game to pieces. Won't be nothing left to eat."
Abner Marsh had only nodded. The rifle wouldn't be worth much for accuracy, especially in Marsh's hands, but it didn't need to be. At close range, it would wipe Damon Julian's smile clean off his face and blow his goddamn head off his shoulders for good measure. Marsh carefully loaded it up and mounted it on the wall above his bed, where he could sit up and snatch it down in one easy motion. Only then did he let himself lie back. And so it began. Day after day, the Eli Reynolds steamed downriver through rain and fog, through sunshine and overcast, stopping at every town and steamboat landing and woodyard to ask a question or two. Abner Marsh sat up on the hurricane deck, in a wooden chair beside the steamer's old cracked bell, and watched the river for hour after hour. Sometimes he even took his meals up there. When he had to sleep, Captain Jurger or Cat Grove or the mud clerk took his place, and the vigil went on. When rafts and flatboats and other steamers went sliding by, Marsh called out,
"You there! You seen a steamer named the Fever Dream?"
But the answer, when he got an answer, always came back,
"No, Cap'n, we sure ain't."
And the folks on the landings and in the woodyards told them nothing. And the river was full of steamboats, steamboats day and night, steamboats big and little, going up the river or down it, or lying half-sunk by the banks. But none of them were the Fever Dream. She was a slow, small boat on a big river, the Eli Reynolds, and she crept along at a pace that would make most steamboatmen ashamed, and her stops and her questions delayed her even more. But still the towns passed, the woodyards passed, the forests and the houses and other steamboats drifted on by in a blur of days and nights. Islands and sandbars were left behind them.
Their pilot steered them deftly past the snags and sawyers, and they moved south, ever south. St. Genevieve came and went. Cape Girardeau and Krosno went by. They put in for a bit at Hickman and longer at New Madrid. Caruthersville was lost in fog, but they found it. Osceola was still, and Memphis was loud. Helena, Rosedale, Arkansas City, Napoleon, Greenville, Lake Providence. When the Eli Reynolds came steaming into Vicksburg one blustery October morning, two men were waiting on the landing. Abner Marsh sent most of the crew ashore. He and Captain Yerger and Cat Grove met with the visitors in the main cabin of the steamer. One of the men was a big, hard sword, with red mutton-chop whiskers and a head bald as a pigeon's egg, dressed in a black broadcloth suit. The other was a slender, well-dressed black man with piercing dark eyes. Marsh sat them down and served them coffee.
"Well?"
he demanded.
"Where is she?"
The bald man blew on his coffee and scowled.
"Don't know." "I paid you to find my steamer," Marsh said.
"She ain't to be found, Cap'n Marsh," the black man said. "Hank and me looked, I tell you that."
"Ain't saying we found nothing," the bald man said. "Only that we ain't got the steamer pinned down yet." "All right," Abner Marsh said. "Tell me what you found."
The black man pulled a sheet of paper from inside his jacket and unfolded it.
"Most of your steamer's crew and near all our passengers left at Bayou Sarah after that yellow fever scare. Next morning your fever dream steamed out. Went upriver from all accounts. We found some woodyard niggers who swear she wooded up with them. Maybe they was lying, but I can't see why. So we know the direction your steamer went in. We got enough folks to swear they seen her go by. Or they think they did, anyway. Only she never reached Natchez," his partner put in. "That's, what, 8, 10 hours upriver?"
"Less," said Abner Marsh. "The fever dream was a damn fast boat."
"Fast or not, she got herself lost between Bayou Sarah and Natchez." "The Red River branches off in there," Marsh said.
The black man nodded.
"But your boat ain't been in Shreveport nor Alexandria neither, and none of the woodyards we check can recall any fever dream."
"Damn," said Marsh.
"Maybe she did sink," Cat Grove suggested.
"We got more," said the bold detective.
He took a swallow of coffee.
"Your steamer was never seen in Natchez, you understand, but some of the folks you were looking for were."
"Go on," Marsh said.
"We spent a lot of time on Silver Street," he said, "asking around. Man called Raymond Ortega, he was known there, and he was on your list, too. He came back one night, early in September, paid a social call to one of the nabobs on top of the hill, and a lot of calls down under the hill. Had four other men with them. One of them fits your description of this Sour Billy Tipton. They stayed about a week, did some interesting things, hired a lot of men, whites, coloreds, didn't matter. You know the kind of men you can hire from Natchez under the hill."
Abner Marsh knew all right. Sour Billy Tipton had scared off Marsh's crew and replaced them with a gang of cutthroats like himself.
"Steamboat men?" he asked.
The bald man nodded. "There's more.
This Tipton visited Fork in the Road. It's a big slave mart," the black partner said. "He bought a mess of slaves, paid with gold."
The bald man pulled a $20 gold piece from his pocket and set it on the table.
"Like this. Bought some other stuff back in Natchez, too. Paid the same way."
"What kind of stuff?" Marsh asked.
"Slaver's stuff," the black man said. "Manacles, chains, hammers. Some paint, too," said the other.
And suddenly the truth of it burst on Abner Marsh like a shower of fireworks.
"Jesus God," he swore. "Paint? No wonder no one has seen her. God damn, they're smarter than I thought, and I'm an egg-sucking fool not to have seen it straight off."
He slammed his big fist down on the table hard enough to make the coffee cups jump.
"We figure just what you're thinking," the bald man said. "They painted her, changed her name."
"My little paint ain't enough to change a famous steamer," objected Yerger. "No," said Abner Marsh, "but she wasn't famous yet. Hell, we made one damn trip down the river and never did make it back up. How many folks gonna recognize her? How many even heard of her? There's new boats coming out most every day. Slap a new name on her wheelhouse, maybe some new colors here and there, you got a new boat."
But the fever dream was big, said Jurger. And fast, you said.
Lots of big steamers on the damn river, Marsh said. Oh, she was bigger than nearly all of them except the Eclipse. But how many folks can tell that at a look without another boat to measure her by? As for fast, hell, it's easy enough to keep her times down. That way she don't get talked about.
Marsh was furious. That was just what they'd do, he knew. Run her slow, at well under her capability, and thereby keep her inconspicuous. Somehow that seemed obscene to him.
Problem is, the bold man said, there ain't no way for us to know what name they painted on her. So finding her ain't going to be easy. We can board every boat on the river, looking for these people you want, but...
He shrugged.
No, Abner Marsh said. I'll find her easier than that. No amount of paint is going to change the fever dream, so I can't tell her when I see her. We got this far, and now we keep going, all the way down to New Orleans.
Marsh tugged at his beard.
Mr. Grove, he said, turning to the mate, fetch me those pilots of ours. They're lower river men. They ought to know the steamers down here pretty well. Ask him if they'll go over those piles of newspapers I've been saving and check off any boat that's strange to them.
Sure thing, Captain, Grove said.
Abner Marsh turned back to the detectives.
I won't be needing you gentlemen any more, I don't believe, he said. But if you should happen to run into that steamer, you know how to reach me. I'll see that you get well paid.
He stood up.
Now if you'll come back to the clerk's office, I'll give you the rest of what I owe you.
They spent the rest of the day tied up at Vicksburg. Marsh had just finished supper, a plate of fried chicken, sadly underdone, and some tired potatoes, when Cat Grove pulled up a chair next to him, a piece of paper in his hand.
It took them most of the day, Cap'n, but they done it, Grove said. There's too damn many boats, though. Must have been 30 neither of them knew. I went over the papers myself, checking the advertisements and such, to see what they said about the size of the boats, who the masters were, that kind of thing. Some names I recognized, and I was able to cross off a lot of stern-wheelers and undersized boats.
How many left?
Just 4, said Grove. 4 big side-wheelers that nobody's ever heard of.
He handed the list to Abner Marsh. The names were printed out carefully in block capitals, one beneath the other. B. Schroeder, Queen City, Ozymandias, F. D. Heckinger. Marsh stared at the paper for a long time, frowning. Something there ought to mean something to him, he knew, but he couldn't figure out what or why for the life of him.
Make any sense, Captain? It ain't the B. Schroeder, Marsh said suddenly. They were putting her together up to New Albany the same time they were working on the fever dream.
He scratched his head.
That last boat, Grove said, pointing. Look at those initials, Captain. F.D., like for fever dream, maybe.
Maybe, Marsh said.
He said the names aloud.
F.D. Heckinger. Queen City. O.Z.
That one was hard. He was glad he didn't have to spell it.
Ozymandias.
Then Abner Marsh's mind, his slow, deliberate mind that never forgot anything, chucked the answer up in front of him like a piece of driftwood thrown up by the river. He'd puzzled over that damn word before, very briefly and not so long ago, when flipping through a book.
Wait,
he said to Grove. He rose and strode off to his cabin. The books were in the bottom drawer of his chest of drawers.
What's that?
Grove asked when Marsh returned.
Goddamn poems, Marsh said.
He flipped through Byron, found nothing, turned to Shelley, and it was there in front of him. He read it over quickly, leaned back, frowned, read it over again.
Captain Marsh, Grove said. Listen to this, Marsh said. He read aloud. My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away.
What is it?
A poem, said Abner Marsh. It's a goddamn poem.
But what does it mean?
It means, said Marsh, closing the book, that Joshua's feeling sorry and beaten. You wouldn't understand why, though, Mr. Grove. The important thing that it means is that we're looking for a steamboat name of Ozymandias.
Grove brought out another slip of paper.
I wrote down some stuff from the papers, he explained, squinting at his own writing.
Let's see, that Ozy, whatever it is, it's work in the Natchez trade. Master named J. Anthony. Anthony, said Marsh. Hell, Joshua's middle name was Anton. Natchez, you say.
Natchez to New Orleans, Captain.
We'll stay here for the night. Tomorrow come dawn, we'll make for Natchez. You hear that, Mr. Grove? I don't want to waste a minute of light. When that damn sun comes up, I want our steam up too, so we're ready to move.
Maybe poor Joshua had nothing left but despair, but Abner Marsh had a lot more than that. There were accounts that wanted settling, and when he was through, there wasn't going to be any more left of Damon Julian than was left of that damn statue in the poem.